The Learning Digital Photography podcast is sponsored in part by Nations Photo Lab. Nations Photo Lab is your source for superior quality prints and products. Check them out at nationsphotolab.com today. I'd also like to welcome Data Robotics as a sponsor of the blog and podcast here at Learning Digital Photography and Canon Blogger. They are throwing in a Drobo FS or S Series Drobo, your choice for the winner. It's a three-day extravaganza only. I made a blog post about it, done a lot of Twitter promotion on this, so you're going to want to make sure you stop in and enter for your chance to win a free Drobo FS or S Series backup system. Thanks to the folks at Drobo for their sponsorship, and welcome to the blog. Last but not least, the blog and podcast are also sponsored by the folks over at Red River Paper. Through the end of this month, you can get $5 off any order if you use promo code CB18. That's Canon Blogger 18 on any order that you submit to Red River Paper. You can also get free shipping on any Red River Inkjet paper sample kit that you order from them. Just use the promo code CBSHIP or Canon Blogger SHIP during checkout, and you can get free shipping on a sample kit order as well. Thank you to all of the sponsors, and on with the show. Welcome once again to Learning Digital Photography. With me on the show again this week is Carrie Garrison of Camera Dojo, and you're listening to episode number 51. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jason. I'm glad to be back.
It's good to have you back. This is becoming a regular occurrence. We might want to start running a joint podcast or something. People are going to start thinking it is a joint podcast. This week we're going to be talking about the big question of whether or not to upgrade your body with the 60D that just came out from Canon and Photokina on the way. You know there's going to be a whole bunch of new bodies coming out from Canon, Nikon, and all them. And we're going to talk about things to consider before you purchase a new camera. All that's coming up on the show, so don't go away. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Learning Digital Photography. As I said, with me on the show today is Carrie Garrison from Camera Dojo, my cohort in camera crime. And we're going to talk – it was an interesting question I got, and I was talking to you about this, and we figured we'd make a good podcast out of this, so we stopped the discussion, and we're just going to relaunch it here. So in launching things, Carrie, what are your thoughts on the Canon 60D that just came out?
Oh, man. That, you know, I guess it depends on where you're coming from.
All right. Well, let's go back a minute then, because where it came from, where this whole thing came from, was a listener question that asked whether or not they should upgrade from their Nikon D70 to the Canon 60D. So it's taking a couple factors into consideration. First off, switching camera systems. And then second off, upgrading a camera body. From one that is, I don't know, how old is this, is the D70? It's fairly old. It's like three or four years old.
Yeah.
So upgrading an entry-level SLR to what I guess we would call mid-grade SLR. So there's two components here, upgrading from entry to mid-grade, and then the other component, switching camera systems. So let's start off the discussion with talking about upgrading from an entry-level camera to a mid-grade camera. First off, do you think that's a good idea to make that kind of a move?
Oh, certainly. I mean, there's a point that a particular body is not going to be up to par with the type of photography that you're trying to accomplish. And, I mean, if I look back over my illustrious career, you know,
it's
I mean, I went an illustrious career too, let me tell you. I went from the Olympus camera line, and I made a switch to the Canon camera line, and I've had the 20D, the 30D, the 50D, and it's each time I've made a switch, it's because I needed something else. I needed higher ISO performance, or I needed more megapixels, or something compelled me to want to upgrade the body. Well, now in some cases that, because I do weddings and things like that, that I also have to have the concern of wearing out the shutter and things like that. But it's less of a concern than it is, do I need the additional features that a new body brings to me?
Well, and that's an interesting point about asking the question about bumping up against the limitations of what the body can provide versus the added features that come with a new body, because I think there's a fundamental difference there that a lot of people really haven't considered often enough when making upgrades. And as everyone knows, we're both gear hounds, you know, and we both look at the technical pros and cons of pretty much everything that comes out, you know, whether it's Canon or Nikon or Olympus or Pentax or whoever. When a new body comes out, we're one of the first sets of people that goes to find out what the specs are. You know, so yeah, we do delve pretty quickly into the technical geek factor element there. But I don't think necessarily that sways our purchasing decisions as much. And I think that's why it's kind of important to make a distinction between bumping up against physical limitations versus salivating over new features or new feature needs.
I think that it really depends. I mean, if we look at going from a 30D to a 50D, you know, you're going from 10 megapixels to 15 megapixels, and now we go to the 60D with 18 megapixels. Well, for me, going from 10 to 15, I mean, that's a 50% increase. I mean, that's a huge difference when in terms of getting enough picture in there that I can crop down and still have a big printable image.
Right, I think that's an interesting point, if I can just jump in real quick about the megapixel war or race or whatever, because I remember something came out about a year or so ago that spoke to the quote-unquote megapixel war, and it spoke to this argument. When you have a 50% increase in the number of megapixels, yes, that can let you crop more, but at what point, if you're not cropping, assuming you're not going to crop, that you're trying to get everything in camera and you're not going to be doing a significant amount of cropping in post, at what point do megapixels not become a factor anymore? At what point would you say, okay, if I'm not going to crop, what is the minimum number of megapixels I need to ensure that I've got a good quality image for my most common print size?
Okay, so that, well, there you nailed it on the head with the last piece of that sentence is
right.
For my most common print size.
Right.
And I'll give you two examples of that. One being stuff I do for the web. If it's something I'm doing that is going to only be on the web, then 5 megapixels is probably plenty. And I'm proving that almost on a daily basis, and so are you, with our daily Android phone picks.
Sure, I mean, sure. That's a great example, yeah.
Getting awesome, and I mean awesome, images of these phones. And we have to, even at that size, 5 megapixels, we have to downsize them so that they're small enough for a web page.
Yeah, you've actually criticized me on that because I've left them native and not done any desampling or anything like that, and left them huge. And you're like, dude, those are too big. You got
They don't fit on a 24-inch monitor. Yeah. I mean, they're flipping huge.
Yeah.
And so what your media is certainly relevant. And if I was printing to 5x7s, 8x10s, 5 megapixels, as long as the image is crisp and sharp and has everything going for it, they're going to print awesome.
So you think a 5-megapixel camera can print up to an 8x10, you're saying?
Oh, pretty certainly. Well. I mean, look at how many megapixels there are, or just how many pixels, period, that there are when it comes to printing. They're going to make a good, solid print. It's just you don't have a whole lot of room for error. Well, you have very little room for error at that point.
At the 8x10 range, I would completely agree with you. That you have very little room for error. So, and I would also venture to say that 8x10 is probably still one of the most common print sizes for really any use. I mean, I would imagine that most wedding portraits come out.
No, actually, it's quite the opposite.
Really?
And it's something ridiculous. It's like 99% of all prints are 5x7s.
Really?
And
it's not going higher than 8x10. What I'm saying is the highest that you would most see in most wedding print scenarios would be 8x10, maybe 11x14. I don't know. How many 11x14 requests do you get?
None. Yeah, I mean, on a given wedding with thousands, you know, well, usually we deliver 1,500 images. You're going to get hundreds of 5x7 prints and 2 or 3 8x10 prints.
Huh. And see, that's interesting because I've actually had, now granted, I don't do a lot of event photography. I'm doing more portraits where people want the 8x10s.
Yeah, but you're not going to print 200 50. Of them.
Right, right.
This is where you're going to put them.
Right.
You're going to pick your best ones and the ones that you're going to hang on the wall, or maybe you're going to give some as gifts. You know,
and I think that's where I'm seeing a lot of mine are in the form of gifts, because if I'm doing a lot of portrait work, like engagement stuff, for example, I'll be doing a headshot of each fiance, and then, you know, a couple joint shots, and they'll get 10 of all three.
Yeah.
So that's like 38x10s. And for me, you know, printing out 38x10s, I want to make sure that everything is really spot on.
Yeah. And that's where you start going, well, where do you really need to be for that? And I think if I look back over the years, 10 megapixels was that point where I felt really comfortable mm-hmm. with the images that I was taking, and you know, I could do pretty much anything.
For
again,
right.
it depending on how I was composing the shot, I sure. may or may not leave much wiggle room available. And then as you move into 15, you know, that was a huge increase.
Right.
And now it's just, okay, you know,
24, 28 megapixels. And
I mean, I still strive to do everything in camera, but when
it's nice having that wiggle
the
room,
flexibility.
Though. Yeah, the flexibility to crop if you need to.
Yeah, and knowing that I can crop a lot.
So that's one factor, I guess, to consider when you're making the move from an entry-level SLR to a mid-grade SLR is what percent increase in megapixel count is that going to have for you? Because the bigger the increase, the more flexibility you'll have in using post-production cropping techniques for creating better prints.
Right. And now if we look at the difference between my 50D and the new 60D, it's a difference of 15.1 versus 18.
See,
and
it's
just not a big difference.
And the same thing holds true for my 40D to the 60D. It's not, for me, I can't justify the increase.
Not okay, and we'll probably go through feature by feature here because this is the new kid on the block here. But yeah, when it comes to megapixels, I don't see a reason to move to that camera for that feature.
Right. And I think the same would hold true for people that are shooting the 40D, the 50D, and then the Nikon equivalent would be the D90, I think, now, right?
Yeah, yeah,
so
somewhere.
So the D90 or older, D90, D80, D70.
Now, the question that came in was about the D70, which is an older camera, and I think that one was probably 10 megapixels. And so if we're going from 10 to 18...
Well, I mean, see, that's where my 40D is, so I don't know. Do you think that...
I mean, 10 to 18 is a 80% increase. I mean, it's a massive increase.
Right,
but
if you're striving to, I guess my whole point there though is if you're getting everything right in camera and you're not doing a lot of post production cropping, is that extra megapixel count needed? And I'm venturing to say that if you're not a wedding photographer or an event photographer or even a portrait photographer, if you're doing landscapes and things like that, the megapixel count isn't. I mean, how much are you really going to crop in post-production?
Well, but don't think of it that way. Think of the landscape photographer and you with a 10 megapixel and him with an 18 megapixel are taking the exact same shot with the exact same lens. You're going to end up with the exact same image, but one of them is going to have a whole lot more detail in it.
See, I'm not so sure I agree with that statement.
I mean, there's more pixels taking in data, therefore...
But see, that's just one element of it. Yes, there's more pixels taking in more data.
I'm saying, all things being equal.
But they're not. Well, that's what I'm
saying.
Well,
that's if all other things are equal, then it stands to reason that a higher megapixel count will give you a sharper image.
Sure, and I totally understand that. But part of the dichotomy there is because all things are equal, with the sensor being the same physical size, the more megapixels you cram onto that, the more noise you're going to get.
Yeah, but I think that that's changed so drastically and been improved over the last few years. I don't think that's really an issue anymore, especially with the noise reduction that we have, the noise reduction built into the Digic processors and things like that. I don't think that's so much of a concern anymore. And
okay. Well,
really,
if it's not as much of a concern, then it's probably not worth bringing into the discussion as far as...
But we have to go back to the other piece of the discussion, which is, what is the output medium? And if all things being equal here, right, mm-hmm. if you're taking the same image with the same lenses and the same scene, and you're both getting the same image, but the one is sharper than the other, now all of a sudden, where is that thing going? Oh, it's going on an 8x10? It's not going to matter.
Okay.
You know, are you shooting it for a billboard? It's going to matter.
It's going to matter hugely, yeah.
So, again, it's where is that end piece going to – what is that print? What is the final destination of that image that determines where you need to be with the rest of the gear there? So all things being equal, yeah, on the monitor, one may be sharper, but once you output it to a 5x7 – it's irrelevant. 8x10, it's irrelevant. Probably 24x30 is irrelevant. But
really?
When you start getting into, I don't know, I'm just saying, once you as the size increases, the relevancy becomes noticeable.
Okay, well, there's a great resource out there that I've used significantly in the past when I've compared camera bodies and I've considered purchases myself. And for people that come into me and ask me questions about should I upgrade from this camera to that camera or switch systems from Nikon to Canon or from Canon to Nikon or Pentax or whatever. The resource that I always go to is my quote-unquote fail-safe measure when I just want to see every feature compared side-by-side-by-side is DxOMark.com. This comes from the folks over at DxO Labs. And what you can do is you go to that site and you can pull down any three cameras at any given point in time and you can run a comparison. And it gives you an overall score, a portrait score, and it speaks to the quality of images that come out of the camera with the same lens. It speaks to portrait, landscape, sports, and then it also compares manufacturer specs, you know, what the street price is, the current street price is. It looks at the resolution, which is the megapixels. It looks at pixel pitch, focal length multiplier, ISO range, frame rate, all that kind of stuff.
So more stuff than you'll probably ever want to know.
More stuff than you ever want to know. And we're talking about three cameras right now. We're not even bringing the 60D into the equation yet because the 60D, you can't even get yet. It's not even going to be out for another couple weeks. So
yeah, they don't put pre-production units on there like right. You'll see on DP Review.
Right. Right, those pre-production ones you won't see. But just in looking at the ones we've talked about, the Nikon D70, the Canon D40, and the Canon D50. Or I'm sorry, the 40D and the 50D. The Canon 40D and 50D are virtually identical with two notable exceptions. Number one is ISO settings. And actually, the ISO settings are relatively similar.
Are you saying the 40D and the 50D?
The 40D and the 50D.
Okay.
And the ISO settings are pretty close. One is at 703 and one is at 696. The only significant difference is that megapixel count, where the 40D is a 10 megapixel and the 50D is a 15 megapixel. Oh, and then I'm actually looking down at the latitude now. And the latitude, the range, the ISO range, on the 40D is 1 to 3200 and on the 50D is 100 to 12.8. So it actually is significant in terms of the range. But those are the only two things, the megapixel count and the ISO settings, or the ISO range on the bodies. So moving up to the 60D, going to, what is it, an 18 megapixel? From the 50D, you were saying it's not enough of an increase to really justify it. What was the frame rate spec for the 60D? Because I know it had the same ISO range.
The 60D is 5.3 frames per second.
Okay, so that actually went down.
It went down from the 50 was 6.3.
And the 40D is 6.5. So in that sense, the 40D and the 50D are similar. So the 60D, it went a step down in terms of frame rate, and it took a step up in terms of megapixels. So the step down, I would say the step down is significant in frame rate, but the step up in megapixel isn't as significant, at least for the 50D.
Okay, and I think we should maybe backtrack a little bit here, because Canon has certainly changed the positioning on the X0D series of cameras. The 10, 20, 30, 40, and 50 were considered prosumer cameras. And then you had the Rebel line, which was the consumer cameras. And now the 60D is no longer at that high end of the consumer market. It has shifted to being the step up from the Rebel cameras. And now if you're, you know, quote unquote, a prosumer or aspiring professional, now you're supposed to go to the 7D. And it's a lateral move instead of a progression of the same model name series.
That's a good point. You're making a lateral. If you're moving from the 40 or 50D to the 60D, it's more of a
There's things about the 60 that are better than the 50, but there's things about it that are a step down from the 60.
So in that regard, it's more of a lateral move. Whereas if you're going from a Rebel line SLR up to the 60D, it's probably a pretty good deal.
Right. I mean,
if
you go down to just the current Rebel, the T2i, now you've got the same megapixel, you've got the same ISO, you go from 3.7 frames per second to 5.3 frames per second. It can shoot more. It's got more a larger buffer. It's got a larger viewfinder coverage. So there's things that are obviously a step up from the Rebel T2-1, but they're not really a step up from the 50D, and in some cases they're either equal or less.
Right. Yeah, because in looking at the Rebel T2i, its overall score is about on par with the 40D and 50D, but when you look at the megapixel, and see, here's the megapixel count, even in the Rebel line, is now in the 18 megapixel range. The T2i is an 18 megapixel camera.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a frame rate of 3.7 frames per second with an ISO range of 1 to 12800. So in that regard, the Rebel T2i is now a step up from the 40D?
Yeah. In fact, in many cases, it's a step up from the 50D. So it's crazy, some of the stuff that they've done.
But it does kind of speak to your point of how a move from the X0D series to another X of the 0D to another in the same X0D series would be more of a lateral move. But if you're making an entry level move from an older Rebel line up to that, I'm saying anything prior to the T2i, it's probably a smarter move for you because you're going to see more of a bump across the board in all your specs.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And just in looking at, so from that basis alone, just looking at the T2i and its counterpart in the Nikon family, which is the D70, in that regard, just in looking at the body specs, it makes a lot of sense to make that upgrade, because you're talking about moving from an entry-level grade to a mid-grade camera.
I mean, now, if you're
formerly was considered a mid-grade camera, because I understand what you're saying of how the quote-unquote mid-grade or the prosumer grade is really moving up a notch, where you're talking about moving to the 70 or the 5D Mark II, or something along those lines.
I mean, that's certainly how Canon's positioning it. Now, the only difference would be if, you know, there's certainly tons of people who are getting into photography and they're trying to do it as a business and they're doing portraits or engagement shoots or weddings or whatever, and they're really happy with their 50D, but they need another camera, and they can't really afford the $600 jump over the 60 to go to a 7D.
Right.
And
that's the hugest change, I think, is because if you look at the geek specs that I like to call them, they're not going to see a whole heck of a lot of difference. At least initially, they're not going to be bumping up against any limitations if they're not bumping up against them in the 40D or 50D line. You know, so from that perspective, the specs don't really matter that much. What matters ultimately,
well,
except
for one,
the megapixels, right?
No, not necessarily. Because like I said, for me, the 15 to 18 wasn't a big difference. But for some people, it's the addition of the video recording.
Oh, yeah, okay, that's a good point about the video.
And that, for many people, is going to be the reason to, if you already have a 40 or 50, to go ahead and get the 60, is so that you're having a crop sensor camera. It's very similar to what you're using. Well, there's some exceptions to being similar. Well, we can talk about those. But, yeah.
Similar,
but different. It's the same thing, only different. But then adding that video is certainly a huge change, unless you're coming from a T2i, which already has video.
Right. And I do think the incorporation of videography into the market is something that, you know, it's been coming for a while. We've seen this coming for a while, and many people have talked about this convergence of still and video, and I don't think there's any avoiding it. I think it's going to become a dual world of still photography and videography within one unit, whether we like it or not.
It's going to be whether you choose to use it or not.
Right, right. Well, that's what I'm saying is I'm going to have
– it's there.
In my next camera, there's going to be the capability of shooting video. It's really just up to me whether or not I want to use it. So, yeah, whether you use it or not, it's going to be there is probably a better way to say it.
Yep.
But just in looking at the 70 then compared to the 60D, it sounds like they've got the same megapixel count because they're both 18 megapixels.
Well, yeah, except the 60D is a 4-channel CMOS sensor and the 70 is an 8-channel CMOS sensor.
Yeah, because I don't have the 60D specs in front of me because the pre-production unit is over on DP Review and that's not on DxO Labs or DxO Mark or whatever it is. I can't see the CMOS sensor comparisons.
Well, I'm actually reading my chart on CameraDojo.com.
Oh. Nice plug. Nice plug. Well, okay, then
I don't know what a big difference that's going to make in terms of image quality and things like that. Can't really...
I think for the most part across the board, though, they're going to be pretty similar. They both got 18 megapixel sensors. They've both got the 1.6 crop factor focal length multiplier, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
They've both got the 100 to 12.8 ISO settings. I think they're both at the 14 bits per pixel.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think the 70 might be 16. I think that's why it has an 8-channel.
I'm looking at the 70.
Okay.
Actually, right now it's 4.
Well, the frame rate is 8 frames per second on the 70.
Right, and it's 5 on the 60D.
5.3 on the 60D.
So now, that's one big. That's probably one of the biggest differences between the 60D and the 70 is frame rate.
Well, and one that really bugs me, and I can't for the life of me figure out why they haven't fixed this, is the viewfinder coverage. This just irritates the hell out of me. The 70 is 100% coverage viewfinder. The 60D is a 96, which is a step up from the 50D, which is a 95, and the 40D, which is like a 94. And it's you take the shot, and then you bring it on the computer, and you're like, wait, there's extra stuff here.
I don't remember composing that way.
Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And now I got to crop it again because it wasn't exactly what I wanted. I'm trying to get it perfect in camera, and then I pull it. I'm like, oh great!
That's
now there's
not
a,
what I did.
I zoomed in just past that telephone pole, and the telephone pole's in the shot.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
And that's just that bugs the hell out of me. So,
but you're not biased or anything. You're just
You're
objectively reporting on sensor data. And,
yeah, and but if for and, for people who don't understand what that means when they see 96% coverage, it means there's 4% that is going to show up after you press that shutter.
Yeah.
So and 5% on the 50D, and it goes down on older cameras, and where the 70. What you see is what you get, which
100%.
That's pretty attractive to me sometimes.
Yeah. No, I can totally get that. I can especially as an event photographer, because the last thing you want to do is do more post-production work than you have to.
Mm-hmm.
So I can totally get that from an event perspective. But just from a sheer technical perspective, if someone's looking to upgrade to the 60D, it sounds like at least we're both in agreement here that you might want to consider the 70, because the only two or three real differences are frame rate, viewfinder size, and then cost.
Okay, well, let's throw in autofocus.
You know, someone else mentioned this to me about autofocus.
I'm just saying, because the
okay, how many autofocus points does the 60D allegedly have?
Okay, the T2i, the 50D, and the 60D, and I'm pretty sure the 40D too are 9 points. There are 9 autofocus center cross type focus points. The 60D improves that by the center one being, you know, perfect up to like f2.8. I don't know what the difference is, but that's, they add that spec to it. The 7D goes from 9 to 19. So almost double the number of autofocus points. So it will focus faster, more accurately, blah, 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 you know.
Now, see, my whole argument here is that with autofocus points, and I'm actually looking through my 40D right now at my monitor as we're having this discussion on Skype, and I see the 9 autofocus points, and how many autofocus points did you say it's going to in the 70?
19.
So you're adding 10 more?
Yeah.
For my eye, and granted I'm an old aging person, but to go from 9 to 19... would just confuse me.
Well,
especially because a lot of what I like to do in camera, when talking about getting it right in camera, what I like to do is select an autofocus point and have it focus on that particular point.
Right, because
I'm doing either macro photography or portrait photography or landscape photography, and the last thing I want my camera to do is pick up that branch that's right in front of me rather than the scene way out in the distance. So what I'll do is I'll set it on infinity, or I'll set on a specific focal point and say, boom, focus here, and then switch it to manual, and it won't hit it anymore. So for me, scrolling between 9 focus points versus scrolling through 19 focus points to get to the one I want to get to, especially if your focus point is the opposite of where you last had it set. Because now, instead of scrolling 4, you're scrolling 9. You have to scroll twice as far to get to the focus point that you want to get to.
Well, I guess that depends on how you have your camera set up. I have the little joystick set up for that, so I can just point in that direction a couple times and I'm one side to the other. So instead of using the wheel to spin through all of them, I use the little joystick and I can go right to it. Because I do use that feature heavily to switch between portrait and landscape mode and stuff. So I'm always flipping my focal points. Now, do I need to go from 9 to 19 for my manual selection? I'm going to say no. I mean, a couple more, I guess, would be nice, but to double it, I don't really need that. What I want it to do is internally have
when
more.
When you're talking about doing the autofocusing.
Yeah. I don't care if there's hidden ones in there that are helping me autofocus, but when it comes to my manual selection, I mean, there's cameras at a 45.
Yeah,
I mean,
and for me, that's just hideous. I don't even want to think. But
can you even see anything through your viewfinder when you're looking at 45 points?
Well, and that was my whole beef about people talking about having more autofocus points. And it's like, well, when you're on autofocus, sure. But for many of us, especially when you start getting past the, and I hate to throw labels, especially on people. But when you start to get past, you know, the simple fact of the matter is there's a learning curve in photography just like anything else. And once you get past the initial just information dump that needs to happen, you know, when you figure out everything there is to know about shutter and aperture and ISO and autofocus points and diopter settings and exposure triangles and rule of thirds, and once you get that initial dump and you've got all the nuts and bolts down, and you step it up a notch, I would say you're more inclined to use the manual focus point selection method than relying on autofocus in camera.
Well, I mean, I'll select which point, and I'll let the camera autofocus from there.
Right, but that's what I'm saying, is you're not going to just be on autofocus where it just
grabs never.
All of them.
No, never, ever.
Yeah, see, you never do that anymore, neither do I, and that's the whole point is, you know, once you move past that entry-level phase where you're gathering all that sundry stuff and you're making sense of it all, and you get to a more advanced point where you're determining what the autofocus point is that you want the camera to use for focusing, the more points you have to scroll through, the more of a pain in the butt it is.
Yeah, but I've also had times where I've got a particular composition and I can't get it to a spot that I want to focus on because... Because
you don't have a focus point there? Yeah. I can see that.
So I guess
it goes, but there's pros and cons. It depends on your perspective. Interesting point. I think the larger issue that I had more of a problem with wasn't so much a comparison between moving from an entry-level camera to a mid-grade or a prosumer or an avid enthusiast camera, whatever genre you want to put on that mid-grade, you know, because I think from that perspective, it makes sense for someone that's looking to move from one body to the next. If you're moving from one group of bodies to the next group, from the entry-level group to the mid-grade group, it makes sense. It's a pretty good investment. So the question really becomes one of which one in the mid-grade group are you going to get? Are you going to get the 50D? Are you going to get the 60D? Is the 50D even still on Canon's website?
Yes.
Okay, so you can still get the 50D. So really,
for the same price as the 60D.
As the 60D.
So $1,099.
So it's not like they're trying to promote the 60D or anything. You know, they're making it, you know, clearly they're trying to promote the 60D over the 50D because they've got them priced the same. Because now it's just to people's financial advantage to get the 60D rather than the 50D.
I mean, yeah, there's enough compelling things in it that if I had a lower-end camera,
right,
that, the 60D is that step up.
Right.
It's just when you're – what they've done at the 50D level
– and the 40D
level. 60, it's just – ouch. Well, I mean, there's even other things. There's how many metering zones, and, mm-hmm. and again, the video could be huge for some people, and
sure.
Live view. The 40D's got live view.
Yeah, I've got live view.
But if you're going 30D, you wouldn't have that.
Right. And I think another big part of it when you're talking about making a move within the same system, it really just comes down to whether or not you're going to be able to take, if there's going to be more features to take advantage of than you otherwise had, like you said, with the video or with an increased frame rate or with more megapixels or whatever. And I actually always fall back on my own background experience because I started off with the Rebel XT. And what I had the Rebel XT when one of my best friends at the time had a 20D. So for me, looking at the 20D compared to the XT was like, oh my gosh, you know, look how much more sturdy that is. Look at the shutter count you can get. You know, that shutter's rated for 100,000 actuations, whereas mine is only rated for 50,000 actuations. Man, this is going to fall apart. This is a total piece of plastic. I need to upgrade. And then the 30D came out. And then the 40D came out. So between the XT and the 40D, there was the 20D, the 30D, and the 40D all at the same time. So for me, moving from the Rebel line to the next phase made perfect sense because of not only doubling up, because I went from 6 megapixels to 10. So like you said, that was a pretty significant jump. And going from the frame rate, my frame rate doubled because I was at 3.2 and I went to 6.2. I think the 40D is. So everything there was just, you know, I doubled up on everything. Even on ISO settings, I think the Rebel XT only went from 100 to 1600, and this went to 3200. So I was doubling up everywhere. It just made perfect sense for me. But like you said, because there's more of a blurring of the lines between the X0D series and the entry level, it's making the decision a little trickier. What was most compelling for me, though, is how this person was saying that they were considering moving from the Nikon D70 to the Canon 60D.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
It makes for an interesting discussion because, and I think there's a larger picture here to speak of, and we know this is the Learning Digital Photography podcast, you know, done in conjunction with Canon Blogger, so everyone knows that I use Canon gear, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm refusing to acknowledge other systems out there because there are plenty of other very good systems out there. Nikon has excellent cameras, even Samsung.
Sony.
But Sony, Olympus, Pentax, I mean...
Olympus cameras are awesome. I love them still.
You name a camera vendor out there and anything that's produced by today's standards are going to yield some pretty good quality pictures as long as you've got the nuts and bolts down. You know, as long as you know how to handle the camera, you can get good shots in anything.
Yeah.
You
now
know, you take a pro, and the point being, you can take a professional shooter, give them mid to high end point and shoot, and they can probably still pull off a wedding shoot. Do you want to shoot a wedding with a point and shoot? Probably not. But you probably could get away with it if you had to in a pinch. So the whole point there is that pretty much any camera system that you get in this day and age can yield really good pictures for you. All right, so it doesn't matter whether you're an Nikon shooter, a Canon shooter, a Pentax shooter, an Olympus shooter, a whatever shooter, a Sony shooter. Take your pick. You know, any camera system is going to work for you.
Yeah, and you know,
can
we're
make
not
it work for you.
I wouldn't say that I'm biased towards Canon either, even though I mean I've had Canon for a number of years. It's I went Canon over Nikon because the people I was shooting with,
that's a big part,
were using Canon, and that allowed me to use some of their equipment until I had enough of my own that I didn't need to borrow anything.
And that's a huge point that I was going to bring up, because a lot of what you're getting into isn't just the camera body. People get so fixated on the camera body, but that's really only one component of a larger system of components that you use when you're taking pictures. And people think, you know, the old saying is, wow, that must be a great camera. You know, you take really good pictures. What kind of camera is that? That camera takes really good pictures. And the old joke is, well, that means the best pots must make the best food for the cooks.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not the gear. It's the person behind the gear. And when you look at the cameras, the cameras don't really matter. What matters is, number one, most importantly, who's behind the camera, and then number two, what's in front of that camera. Because I can take my 40D, or you can take your 50D, and we can put a piece of cheap glass on the front of it, you know, a piece of glass that sells for $150 versus one that sells for $1,500. And which one do you think is going to be optically and pictorially, or have a better pictorially, if that's a word, have a better picture quality?
Mm-hmm.
You know, optics are going to be always the most powerful indicator of the quality of images. It's not the camera that's producing these super sharp pictures. It's the lens that's producing
the lens.
The lens
makes
sharp.
A huge difference.
And that's where and the standard, you know, ideology, or the standard phraseology that people use, is don't invest in your camera, invest in your glass. Because the glass or the lenses is really where the superior optical quality, or the more money you invest, the bigger return you're going to get on your investment. And if you look
in terms of quality.
Yeah, in terms of picture quality, and also in terms of retention, of value retention. If you look at camera bodies, if you try and sell last year's model used, the return on your investment is horrible. It's like a car. As soon as you drive a car off a lot, it depreciates in value. The same holds true for cameras. As soon as you buy a camera, it starts depreciating in value. With lenses, that's not as true. When you buy a lens, yes, it depreciates in value, but only to a certain degree.
And it's so minimal.
Yeah, and the general rule of thumb is 10%. Once you buy a lens, now that it's used, you can probably get it for 90% of what it would cost full price.
And I think there's exceptions to that.
There are exceptions to that, but
look at either the Canon or the Nikon 7200
2.8. Yeah.
IS. Brand new for $1,600. You buy them used for $1,599.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just they lose almost nothing.
Yeah, they absolutely lose.
They're almost an investment.
And it is an investment at that point, and that's what I like. That's what I like to tell people is, when you're buying a camera, you're not buying just the body; you're buying into a camera system. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at the lenses that camera system has. You have to look at the accessories that camera system has, and a big one that has kind of been a barrier. I was really torn when I was first getting into the digital photography side of things, because I knew Nikon had that CLS system for their flashes, and Canon didn't. And that was, at the time, I didn't understand how big it was. I understood that there was a difference, but I didn't understand the intensity of the difference until I started getting more into it. And had I known then what I know now, I might have been the Nikon blogger. just because the commander system that Nikon has, and we should probably back up just a little bit and explain what the CLS or the commander system is. You can control accessory flashes for Nikon bodies even if they're not connected to the camera. The little pop-up flash on your SLR camera for an Nikon until very... Well, the pop-up flash on and was only on a Nikon would the pop-up flash control accessory flashes. Now, the 60D...
And the 70.
And I think the 70 did that too, yeah. So the 60D and the 7D now have that built in as well. But up until then, and what, the 70 came out when? Last year? September of last year, I think. So it's only been out for a year. I mean, literally, it's been out for a year that Canon has had that feature available. Up until then, that feature wasn't available. So the whole point of this, though, is to...
Well, without buying... like the STE2 for $200.
Right, but I'm talking about native
in the camera.
In camera ability to control exterior flashes. So when you buy your exterior flashes on the Canon system, not only did you have to buy the exterior flash, but you had to buy the STE2 to control that flash. So from the Nikon perspective, yes, you may be paying $350 for the SB800 or $400 for the SB900. And you're only paying, what, $300 for the 580EX? How much is a 580?
Well, a 580EX2 is four and change.
That's four and change. Okay, so they're roughly the same price for the flashes, but then you had to spend another $200 on the STE2 if you're on the Canon side.
That's right.
So that was an accessory factor that you had to take into consideration. Then you also had to look at the number of lenses available. And this actually brings up an interesting discussion point about buying third-party glass versus vendor glass, like the camera body or the Canon body with a Canon lens or a Nikon body with a Nikon lens. And as much as I'm in favor of mirroring up vendor glass with that body because it's going to work the best, I am actually starting to move away from that mentality because I've been shooting a lot of Sigma lenses lately and they're producing really good quality images that are on par with, and on a few occasions, I almost would venture to say better than the Canon lenses.
Yeah, I think in some cases you're right. I mean, I actually own two Canon lenses. I have the 70-300 and the 51.8.
Ooh. And I'm looking at the 51.8. You selling that?
No.
Do you hang on to that?
I'm hanging on. Oh, I mean, it was like $100.
Yeah.
You know,
I need to get one.
It's got really bad low light performance in terms of autofocus, but man, when you need something that's got just no depth of field, I mean, it's not
paper
a 1.6,
thin.
It's not a 1.4, but
it's pretty paper
0.8
thin.
Is still pretty damn thin.
Right. But if you're looking at these lens systems, though, if you look at the Canon body of, I should use a different term, the Canon family of lenses or series of lenses versus the Nikon family or series of lenses, you have to look at what it is you're going to shoot and whether or not the lenses that they have available will match up with your shooting needs or requirements. And there are some that are pretty comparable where you can see like the 70 to 200 range or the 28 to 135. There's some that are pretty comparable no matter which system you're in. But I do think that Canon does have a wider selection of lenses natively, just natively, within the Canon EOS family. They have got a wider selection of native lenses available than the Nikon family. Not by much. I don't think the numbers are too different.
But there's also a lot of specialty lenses in there, so I know.
Yeah, because there's the tilt-shift lenses and some fisheye lenses that I don't think Nikon has.
Yeah, so I think for general purposes,
it's not going to matter too much. Right. You're right. But that is something to consider. I'm just throwing it out there that is something to consider. Now, having said that about the native Canon lineup versus the native Nikon lineup, when you start getting into other vendors like the Sony and the Pentax, well, not so much about the Pentax because they've got, I think all their current bodies will match up with their entire history of lenses. I think you can use any Pentax lens for as long as they've been in business on their current bodies. And they're one of the originals. So they've got a pretty extensive lineup of lenses as well. I think they've got a few more than Canon does. I'm not sure what the numbers are, but they're pretty competitive. But if you look at the Olympus lenses and the Sony lens lineup, it's not as extensive as the larger players in the photography space. Now, having said that, we did kind of mention third-party lenses, and we mentioned Sigma, but there are some other options out there as well. There's Sigma, there's Tamron, and the other one that I've used is Quantaray.
On Tokina.
That's right. I have a Tokina extender. So, yeah, Quantaray, Tokina. So we have these other options available to us, and what these third-party vendors do is they'll make lenses for multiple body styles for multiple vendors. So Sigma will make a 70 to 200 or an 18 to 250 that will have a mount for both the Canon and the Nikon system. And I think they even do a few Pentax bodies too.
Yeah.
So no matter which brand you're shooting, you can pick up third-party lenses. That's the larger point of what I was getting at. And a lot of people are quick to dismiss them because, well, you know, the Canon body needs the Canon lens, or the Nikon body needs the Nikon lens. That may be true to a degree, or it may used to have been true to a degree.
I definitely think it used to be true, right? Because it just to me, even a few years ago, if you were going to ask about Sigma lenses or the Tamron lenses, you'd say, well, yeah, those are great. If you're on a budget, you know, or if you're looking for cheap stuff,
right?
But now, like Sigma's, their DG line, I mean, that's their Sigma Pro Series.
Oh my gosh, I'm really getting hooked on the Sigma lenses. I am testing right now a Sigma 8-16mm.
Yeah, I mean we had fun with that.
Yes, we did.
And this, but I've been shooting weddings with a Sigma 24-70 DG. I've been shooting weddings with that thing for 3 years. Yeah. I mean, I love that lens. And I just tried their new version of it. Oh, it was nice.
They're really getting up there in terms of optical quality. I'd say they're superior optical quality to the third-party lenses of yesteryear.
The one I have in my bag right now is the 30mm 1.6. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give it back.
Yeah.
This thing's been cool.
You only have a couple weeks left.
The 105mm macro.
Awesome. Yeah, I've got the 70mm macro, so yeah. And I think that just underlines the larger point that third-party lenses are not the redheaded stepchild.
Not anymore.
That they used to be. You know, and it used to be that, oh, well, it's a Tamron, and that's okay if you're on a budget, and Sigma, it's okay if you're on a budget. Now, I'm not sure Quantaray has really stepped up as much as some of the other third-party vendors have, like Sigma and Tamron, because they do have what I've seen most significantly from Sigma and Tamron is they do have what you alluded to, or I think he's actually said, was a professional-grade lens. The DG lenses on the Sigma line, for example, are professional-grade, where they have superior optical quality. And I don't want to say they're on par with or the same as the Canon L lenses, because I know that's not always going to be the case, but they're pretty darn close.
They're very good.
They're extremely close. And the same holds true for Tamron. I think Tamron has a professional line.
They do, but do you really need to spend the money for the Pro Series? And this is, what are you shooting? What is it going out to? All these factors that play in. And I'll tell you, one lens, I don't remember where I got it. It's been so long. I've got the Tamron 12-24, and I'll pull that out at receptions and stuff, and I've been using this thing for like 4 or 5 years, and I'm sitting there reading David Zeiser's blog one day, and that's one of his favorite lenses for receptions. Same exact lens. I mean, so I'm thinking, well, hell, I mean, if this thing's good enough for David Zeiser, I'm not replacing it anytime soon.
Yeah, who is that? I've heard of him. You know,
this is not a high-end lens. It's not part of a Pro Series line. It's a basic Tamron 12-24 lens. It's nothing special, but it makes great images. So it all plays into the whole system that you're looking at. And again, what is that output going to be?
Right.
No one's taking reception photos and printing them for, you know, 50-inch wall hangings. I mean, it's not like that. So, like, you know, ooh, look, there's Drunk Bob, you know.
Yeah, yeah. There's the capability of printing, and then there's the reality of printing is how I like to phrase it. So, because there's what you could print to, and then there's what you really print too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, no one's going to take a picture of the bridesmaid passed out on the floor and make a huge print of it. I mean, as funny as that might be.
Unless they want to, like, blackmail her or something.
Yeah. And in that case, I'm thinking image quality, not so important, you know?
Right, right.
It could even have a little noise in it at that point, you know?
And even if there's a drop shadow on it and a little clip art effect around it, whatever. Maybe a little speaker text coming off of the body or whatever. But, yeah, I think it speaks to a good point. And even just looking at the DxOMark, and here's another cool thing about the DxOMark site is the DxOMark site is that you can compare camera bodies and you can also compare lenses. So what I just did is I went and pulled up the Sigma 18-250, the Canon 18-200, and the Nikkor 18-135. And they all have the f3.5 to 5.6 or 6.3. So they're pretty comparable lenses in terms of their overall range. Now, some would argue that the range isn't exact, and you're not going to get that. You know, vendors aren't going to make 100% comparable lenses between them. You know, Canon and Sigma aren't going to say, all right, let's both produce an 18-250 and see how people, you know, see which one people buy. You know, they're going to make it a little bit different. So Sigma made the 18-250, Canon made the 18-200. Sigma made it probably to appeal to those that have the 18-200 to give them a little more reach. You know, mm-hmm. And the same holds true for Canon making the 18-200 over the Nikkor 18-135. You know, it's just reach. But when you look at optical quality between these lenses, they're actually pretty comparable. Between the three lenses, their peak scores were 23, 20, and 29.
Yeah.
4.5 stars, 4 stars, 4 stars. Resolution 42, 42, 45. Distortion 0.4, 0.5, 0.7. Chromatic aberration 8, 11, and 10. Whatever UMs are, I don't know what those are. Point being is the differences between lenses in today's day and age are not what they used to be. They're so minuscule, it's almost a negligible difference at this point. For most people, I would say it is. You know, unless you're getting down to the real nitty-gritty where you're zooming in to 100% and you're looking for the tiniest little bit of chromatic aberration, yeah, you might find a little more in one lens versus another. But you know what? Lightroom fixes that really easily.
Yes, it does.
That may be a plug for Lightroom, I'm not sure. But the underlying point is that lenses have gotten so competitive that the optical quality really is on par regardless of which vendor you go through. So that just kind of wraps up the whole idea of lenses when you look at buying into a camera system. Flashes are also becoming relatively negligible because can anyone really tell the difference between light output on an SB900 versus a 580 EX2?
No, that's awfully close anyway.
Most people can't, and, you know, unless you're a real student of lighting and photography, you're not going to be able to tell much of a difference. You're really not. So it really comes down to the camera system and what works for you. And this is a big argument or discussion point that I make for people when they talk about computer differences. You know, and you hear the age-old debates of Canon versus Nikon, and the argument holds true for Mac versus PC. You know, some people will be like, oh, I shoot Canon, that's all I shoot, and they don't think Nikon is really worth the time of day. And by the same token, you know, people that, oh, I use Mac and PC doesn't deserve my acknowledgement because they don't get the time of day. Well, it's not really the case anymore. You know, it really is just going to be a function of what works best for the individual. And this is what surprised me about the person that asked the question, because having had the D70, they know the Nikon system. You know, the intuitive interface or the position of buttons in relation to one another is going to be pretty similar when you move from one SLR to another SLR within the same family of.
Given the exception of going from the 50D to the 60D, where they've completely dorked things up and added different controls, but.
But you digress.
But I digress.
Overall, though, I'm saying, like, if you look at the menus, now I'm not talking about the buttons, but if you look at the menus, they're pretty consistent. And changes that are made incrementally, where they're not changing everything all at once. And I know the 60D is your bugaboo, so I'll let you vent on that for a minute. So go ahead and talk about the 60D changes.
Well, I think that was such a silly move. Now, granted, they're going to say that they did this in order to streamline the interface and make it easier to use and all that, which... Sorry.
You're dog. Making me do post-production in audio.
Oh, my dog jumped up on my lap and I sneezed. As much as I think that the new control layout on the 60D is actually probably an improvement, hard to say without actually using it, but I think it actually might be an improvement. The fact is, it hasn't changed in five previous generations. So now, if I was handed, just out of the blue at a wedding or somewhere, whatever, if someone said, here, take a picture, and they hand me a 60D, I don't know how to use it. I have to actually look at it and try and figure out where the controls are, because they're actually different controls.
Right. No, and that's a good point, because things do change, and I think the 60D is probably the first instance where there's been a significant change in interface and layout. I really don't think they're going to change it back.
No.
You know,
no, and
the next iteration...
It's certainly an improvement over the Rebel line, but again, it's going to be a big change
right.
from the Rebel line, and it's a big change from the X0D line. So it's completely different from anything Canon's done in the past. And while it may become the new standard, which is fine, it is something that is dramatically different.
It just means you're going to have to learn a new system. And
yeah.
I guess the point I'm trying to make there is, if someone's moving from the D70 and the Nikon line to the 60D, or even the 50D for that matter, they're going to be learning an entirely new system. Now, granted, you'd be doing that same learning curve all over again if you move from the Rebel line up, but I can't believe I'm saying this, but if someone's shooting a Nikon camera, why would you leave that?
Well, if you've only got one lens, if the only lens that you have is your kit
right.
lens.
And that is the answer as to why, is if you're not fully vested in that system yet.
Right. You know, sell that one and go to a 60D with a kit lens.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Fine. Sell one easily on Craigslist. Buy the other one. You're set. If you've got, you know, gosh, it doesn't take much to have $1,000 invested in lenses.
No.
You know,
one lens, actually. One good quality lens, and you're there.
You know, $600-$700 a lens. I mean, you've got two lenses on top of your kit lens. Now you're invested. And it doesn't make sense to me to move from one manufacturer to the other at that point.
Right.
Because,
and I would say the only people that really have that kind of a luxury are professional shooters. You know, where they're sponsored by camera vendors, where Lexar and Canon are sponsoring them and saying, we'll let you use our gear if you say you're a Canon shooter and use this. Or an
yeah,
shooter, this.
But, you know, even that. I mean, if you're making so much money that $1,000 doesn't really mean much to you for new hardware, it doesn't mean anything. So
right.
it's not that big of a deal.
Right.
But when you're...
For most people, though, I would think that is enough of a deal, because generally... And I threw this percentage out earlier, but generally, you're going to lose about 10% of your investment when you go and sell lenses. So for every lens that costs $1,000, you're going to get $900. Well, if you've got five lenses in your kit, that's a $500 loss there. So
right.
So you're going to lose $500 to move from one system to another.
Now, see, and I look at it from my perspective going, well, since I'm in a particular manufacturer's line, and the fact that I shoot weddings and other things, where to me having a backup piece of equipment is not just a luxury, it's absolutely mandatory.
It's a
that
sure.
I want my backup to be relatively close to my main camera.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're an event photographer, like a wedding photographer or something like that, where you need to have a backup, the last thing you want to do is have a primary camera in one family and a backup camera in another family.
Well, or even in the same family, have them too diverse. Right now, I've got a 30D as my backup and my 50 as my primary. That's as far of a difference as I want to go.
Right. If this guy had this D70 from Nikon to upgrade to a 60D, you know, take a moment of pause and think about this, because you're talking about moving from one complete system to another completely unique system where not only are the controls different and the menus are different, but the camera mounts are different.
Does it make sense, based on the resale value of the D70, to keep it and buy a newer Nikon and have the D70 as a backup?
Right. And that's the whole point that I was getting at, is at a certain point, it's usually best to stay within your own camera system. And the ultimate answer is, I don't know what worked best for this guy. I don't know which route he ended up going. But I gave him these recommendations in a short and sweet point. I didn't go into all these kinds of details. But because so many people have asked so much about which camera, you know, should they get, you know. And if you're buying in for the first time, like if you don't have an SLR and you're just moving up, like say you're moving up from a point and shoot to one that has a removable lens to an SLR, then it doesn't really matter as much, because the system that you're buying into for the first time. So at that point, you're not really switching systems. You're entering into a system. And there, my best recommendation actually would be to not buy initially. That would be my recommendation, to not buy anything initially. Because if you're going to be investing $1,000 in a body, and you're going to invest another $1,000 in lenses, and you're going to invest probably another $500 to $1,000 in one or two flashes ultimately, you're talking about a $3,000 investment or somewhere in that neighborhood to get a good kit together. $3,000, that's a lot of money, especially in today's economy. That's a lot of money. I would rather spend $100 or $200 and try my two or three favorites for a week each. You know, you get a D90 or a Nikon 300 or the Canon 50D or 60D or 70 or whichever one, and rent them. You can rent them through places like Rent Glass and Lens Pro to Go, Borrow Lenses. There's a whole bunch of sites out there. We can throw links to that in the show notes. But you can rent them very cheaply these days. And renting them will give you a chance to get out of the – because you can go to a store and look at them. You can go to Wolf Camera, Ritz Camera, whoever your local camera shop is, and you can play with the buttons in the store and try to get an idea for it. But you're not really going to get an idea for how it works for even half an hour spent inside a store pushing the buttons and twisting the dials. The only way you're really going to get to know all the buttons and dials and how everything works is to take it out and use it for a certain amount of time. And I would say a week is a good amount of time. And after you've used each for a week, so say you're debating between an Nikon and a camera system and a Canon system or a Pentax system, you get each one for a week. You've invested $300 max in all of these, because it's $50 for a body and $50 for a lens. Boom. $100 each for a week. And get a comparable one, because that way you can also compare image shots and you know, image quality. And see which one you learn the quickest. And that's the ultimate test for me. See which one you learn the quickest. Because the system that you learn the quickest is the one that is most intuitive for you. And that ultimately would probably be the best barometer or gauge to use when buying into an SLR system. Which one makes sense for you? Which one feels the best in your hands? You know, at that point, it's all a matter of touch and look and feel and how intuitive things are to you. You know, if you're just buying into it, that really is my best recommendation. But, you know, that's just, I don't know. If someone were to come to you, Carrie, and ask, I'm thinking of getting an SLR, what should I get?
What's your budget?
The first question is, what's your budget? And then,
what are you shooting?
What are you shooting?
And you know, right now, it's really a tough call. I mean, there's some fine lines between some different products. I mean, I certainly know the Canon line far better than, well, let me be honest here. I don't know the Nikon line. I know that the D90 was the first one to have video. I mean, that's about the extent of my knowledge of the Nikon line, other than I think the way it goes is the higher the number, the better the camera. So,
well, that's generally true across most camera lines. Sure.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, if you go to 50D, 60D, 7D, that's, well, doesn't the 7 is less than a 50?
Right.
So,
but if you're shooting Canon, that's the 1D.
How about a 1D? So if the single digit on a Canon, it's pretty good, but a 7 is worse than a 1. Okay.
They're changing their numbering system. You can tell some changes are coming, but
and Nikon, you know, has some strange things with some numbering, and like the D3000 or the D300. I really don't know the differences between them. I mean, I'm not a Nikon shooter, but I would also say, well, do you have friends that shoot a particular brand?
And that's actually originally what sold me on the Canon lineup, was that everyone that was around me that was shooting digital photography had the Canon EOS line, whether it was a 10D or a 20D. And I think the 30D had just come out, or someone else. No, it was they were shooting 10D, 20D, and someone had the X. What was one before the XT? The XS?
The Rebel, yeah.
Yeah, the Rebel XS was the one that was hit. So the four people that I knew were shooting a 10D, a 20D, an XT, and an XS.
Well, and I guess the second part of that is, what are your friends shooting, and are they the type of friends that will let you borrow?
Sure.
Because if they're not, I guess the first part of that is irrelevant.
It doesn't really matter, sure.
And, you know, I have one friend. He's got a lot of good equipment, won't let anyone borrow it. I don't blame him. You know what? It's his equipment. He has every right to say that he doesn't want someone to borrow it, because if it breaks, it's expensive.
Yeah, it's expensive.
And if you don't have the insurance and stuff to replace it, you know, he could, you know, you can run into an issue with a friend if you break, you know, an expensive piece of glass. And I have others and myself, if I'm shooting with people and they're like, oh, a lens baby, is that, what's that like to shoot? I'm like, put it on your camera. You know,
I don't know.
What do you want me to tell you? Just put it on your freaking camera and try it. And so I'm very open about letting people use my gear when they're around.
I would venture to guess that most of the time, the friend factor is a worthwhile factor to consider. Because, yeah, there may be some people out there that are particular about their gear and they don't like lending it out, but I tend not to be friends with people like that.
Well, and there's also...
And if I am, I respect it, and I don't even ask.
You know, but there's also other situations.
I also don't ever offer, so...
I'll just throw out this actual instance that happened last year. A friend of mine shooting a wedding, and I don't know exactly what happened, but he was standing under the eave of a house, and all of a sudden, this big sheet of water came off and just drenched his camera. And I was 20, 30 minutes away, but he calls me up. He's like, oh my God, you know, my camera just got drenched. It's not going to work. And what am I going to do? And I'm like, okay, well, I'll be there in 20 minutes. And I loaned him a camera. And because it was a Canon and Canon, I didn't have to let him borrow all my lenses as well. He just put his lenses on my body and he shot for the rest of the day. And then at the end of the day, he came, you know, I actually grabbed his camera and I put it in a bag full of this little silicone packets and to help dry it out. And, right. And in the end it was fine. And
really, it dried out. Okay.
I don't think inside that it got that wet. I mean, these cameras can actually take quite a bit before they suck water in.
We're not recommending you douse your camera, by the way. Don't go start throwing water all over your camera because you think it's safe.
But this was a 40D, yeah. And they're not known for their weather sealing, but getting a little splash on them isn't going to hurt them. It's getting them submerged is bad.
Right.
You know,
you never
and
want to submerge them.
A long exposure to moisture is going to be bad. But this was very quick. But he just freaked out, and I don't blame him for freaking out because he was shooting a wedding.
Yeah, I probably would too, even if I wasn't shooting a wedding.
But, you know, it was one of those things that I could take another body out to him and put his in a bag, and the next day we checked it, and it was, like, totally dry, and everything was good. So, but when you have friends like that where if an emergency occurs...
It'd be nice to have that fallback.
Yeah. And, you know, I certainly have a number of friends, except for one who shoots Nikon, who I could call and say, hey, I got an emergency. And right. They would drop everything to come in and help out and swap out some equipment for a short period of time. And
I think the friend factor, though, what we're getting at here is that the friend factor is really something that also should be, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, factoring into your decision. Because if all your friends are Canon shooters and you go out and get a Nikon, not only are you not going to be able to borrow their lenses, but if push comes to shove, who do you ask for help in an emergency where you need to have a spare body to fall back on because you don't have one?
Or just in general questions.
Hey, how do you do this?
How did I do this? and the other guy, oh, yeah. It's under, you go to menu, and then you go here, and oh, that's where it is.
Right. You know, yeah, I think the friend factor is definitely one that is worth taking into consideration. And we've talked about a lot of considerations here. Moving from one lens system to another or one camera system to another is a big consideration. You know, the friend factor is one. Knowing your current menu system is another. Cost is another thing. Lens compatibility is another. I mean, there are so many factors to take into account. It's a tough decision to make, and a lot of people try and boil it down to price. And I guess the underlying theme that I think I'm trying to get across here is that it's not just about price. You know, you got to put your wallet away at some point and look at things from a realistic perspective. What kind of support am I going to have? What kind of accessories am I getting? How difficult is the switch going to be? What's going to be the learning curve? You know, the friend factor, all these kinds of things. These are things you need to take into consideration.
But if you live in the middle of nowhere, you have no friends, there's no stores around, so you have to buy everything online, and so your actual equipment choice is irrelevant. Guess what? Your choice is pretty irrelevant. You know, whether you go with Olympus, which I love Olympus. That was my first one. I bought one for my daughter. I absolutely adored that camera. Mm-hmm. If you go with Canon or you go with Nikon, you can't go wrong. I mean, they're all
good. Unless you submerge it in water, but...
Well, yeah, but there's... Any of the major brands that you go with, you're going to get great pictures. You can't really say, well, is between these two similar model lines between Nikon and Canon, does this one take better images? No, they don't really.
And you can't. And that's the other part of this is you can't really make those comparisons anymore. You know, I think maybe you might have been able to 10, 20, 15, 20 years ago, there might have been significant enough differences between different vendors where you could do that. But even then, I'm not so sure it applied. And I'm not so sure it applied.
Okay, well, I guess in some ways, because...
Well, I wasn't shooting 20 years ago, I was...
Well, even today, I think there's points where... especially between Nikon and Canon, because they're the most popular.
Yeah, and who are we kidding here? That's basically the difference.
Features will leapfrog.
Right.
And you know what? Yeah. If your typical situation is shooting in dark nightclubs, you might want to go Nikon.
Because they've got better ISO handling right now. Yeah. They do, bottom line.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. If one of your key things is that you want to shoot 1080p video,
you got to go with Canon.
Because Nikon does 720, you know. So
I'd say overall video quality. It's not even the HD factor. I think Canon video quality has always been a notch above Nikon. So, and like you said, it's the leapfrog thing. You know, one vendor will have a better feature A, and the other vendor will have a better feature B, and then the feature B ratchets up a notch by one vendor, so feature A ratchets up a notch by the other vendor, and they just go back and forth. And you know, you can play these purchasing games.
Yeah, I mean, I know wedding photographers who had shot Canon for years. The new Nikons came out, and they invested thousands of dollars in new Nikon gear for that enhanced ISO. I mean, to them, it was worth it so that they could shoot in these dark churches, and a lot of churches are dark, and a lot of them don't allow flash. Mm-hmm. That ISO performance was a deal maker for them. They absolutely had to have it.
Or the lack of it in Canon was a deal breaker,
right? And now Nike or Canon, even the best Canons we have, still don't have the ISO performance. It's typically good enough because we can shoot at a 5D Mark II can shoot at 25,000 ISO, you know. So, I mean, do you need 64,000? Do you need 128,000 ISO?
If you need it that high, well,
you know, I mean, your choices are very, very clear cut at that point. You have to go with the one that supports it,
right?
But that's generally not the case. I mean, yeah, you're talking streets.
And I think we've probably hit this point home well enough that when you start getting into the upper echelons between the professional grade cameras, you're not listening to this podcast, or B, you are listening to this podcast and you either agree with us 100% or you disagree with us 100%. If you agree with us, thanks for listening. If you disagree with us, shoot us emails. Kerry's email address is idontcarewhatyouthink@cameradojo.com, and my email address is ireallydontcarewhatyouthink@kenamarga.com. No, I'm kidding. We do care what you think. Do feel free to email us with any questions, comments, or feedback you have on the show. I mean, it's been a really good conversation. We've gone on for quite a bit about, you know, the different bodies, what they offer, what they lack, moving between systems, accessories, lenses, all those kinds of things. It really has been a great show. Kerry, thanks for stopping in and talking with me about this. It's always fun having someone to talk to rather than talking to an empty monitor.
Right. And for people who listen to this show and who don't necessarily listen to the Camera Dojo show, Jason was a recent guest on the Camera Dojo podcast, and we talked a lot about getting your initial lighting kit.
Oh, yeah, because we mentioned lighting here. Go listen to his podcast where we talk about the lighting.
We've had a lot of great comments on that it really helped people. So cool. If you are one of those four people who listen to this show and not Camera Dojo, then I encourage you to come over to CameraDojo.com and check out the podcast that Jason was just on.
Thank you very much, Kerry. And for those of you that have been listening, thank you for listening to the Learning Digital Photography podcast. Kerry, thanks again for coming on the show. Like I said, it's always fun having you on, or we can chew the fat on photo gear and what's coming up and different comparisons, all that fun
stuff.
Geek
out.
That's right. We were geeking out tonight. Any other questions, feel free to email me. The address, as always, is jason@canonblogger.com. If you want to get a hold of Kerry and ask him something about wedding photography and event photography, where can they reach you?
You can check me out at cameradojo.com or kerrygarrison.com. I'm sure he'll put it in the show notes there. You know, of course, all the Twitter and Facebook and all that good stuff. But
just Camera Dojo, Kerry Garrison.
Check out Camera Dojo or Kerry Garrison, and, yep, and you'll hook up with me.
You'll find
me. Jason, it was a pleasure being on the show once again.
Yeah.
And always fun.
We keep wrapping up. I think we spent 10 minutes on our wrap-up time, so I'm going to let it end there. Kerry, you have a good night. Everyone, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.
Bye-bye.